Good evening and welcome to the Pilots of Top Gun. Tonight we have a special panel of some of the most talented and influential naval aviators to ever graduate Top Gun. We'll hear about their experiences at the United States Navy Fighter Weapons School, also known as Top Gun, and its impact on naval aviation and its inspiration for the movie. So my name is Adam Jackson, call sign Roloff, and after graduating flight school in 2009, I deployed twice to the Middle East. And then upon the return from those deployments, I was selected to be a Top Gun instructor and served on the Top Gun staff from 2013 to 2016. During my time, I served with some of the most talented pilots in the world and some of the most hardworking men and women in the United States military. After that time, I served as a training officer and department head, deploying again twice, this time to the Middle East as well, flying over Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and Somalia. And I was recently selected for command and will soon lead the Black Lions of VFA 213 on board the United States Navy's newest operational aircraft carrier, the USS Gerald Ford. All right. All right, so tonight is not about me, but it's about our special panel. So the first one we're going to introduce is Pete Pettigrew, call sign Viper. So he deployed to the skies of Vietnam and then was subsequently asked to be one of the very first Top Gun instructors, serving on the Top Gun staff from 1969 to 1972. After the completion of that tour, he deployed again to Vietnam using his advanced training down to a MiG-21 fishbed. And then after that time, he was asked by Paramount Pictures to be a technical advisor on the 1986 classic Top Gun. And it's even rumored that Tom Skerritt's character, Viper, was based upon him. All right. Next up is Randy Cunningham, call sign Duke. So he deployed to Vietnam as well, flying F-4 Phantoms off the USS America. And then he returned to the United States as one of the very first students to go through the Top Gun course. He then deployed back to Vietnam, serving with VF-96, flying off the USS Constellation, and taking that advanced training, he downed 5 MiGs in less than 5 months in 1972. But that's not it. When he returned, he was asked to serve as an instructor on the Top Gun staff, and then later commanded an adversary squadron. He flew over 300 combat missions, earned the Navy Cross, 2 Silver Stars, and a Purple Heart. So let's give it up for Duke. All right. Next, we have Willie Driscoll, call sign Irish. So after he completed his radar intercept officer training, he deployed with VF-96. And together with Duke, they flew F-4 Phantoms over the skies of Vietnam. And the two together earned 5 MiG kills, becoming the first 2 and only naval aces of the Vietnam War. And just like Duke, he was asked to serve as a Top Gun instructor following that deployment. And even though he did retire, he's still asked to speak to every graduating class of Top Gun. So let's give it up for Irish. Next, we have Dave Barnick, call sign of Bio. So he also completed radar intercept officer training, and he was assigned to the Navy's newest fighter jet at the time, the F-14A Tomcat. He completed his initial junior officer tour and then was asked to serve as a Top Gun instructor. And while he was on the Top Gun staff, he was asked to serve as a technical advisor. And his job was to perfect the dialogue to ensure an accurate depiction of naval aviators in the movie. And above that, he was even asked to fly in some of the specific flight sequences that you can all recall from the movie Top Gun in 1986. He eventually commanded a Tomcat squadron and ended his career with over 3,000 tactical jet hours and 688 carrier arrested landings. Let's welcome Bio. All right, and last but not least, we have Lloyd Abel, call sign Bozo. So he completed his initial training flying the F-14 Tomcat and then deployed on the USS Carl Vinson, flying F-14s with VF-51, the Screaming Eagles. They returned from their deployment at the same time Paramount Pictures was beginning the filming of the 1986 film. And he was hand-selected as one of the very few Tomcat pilots to film many of the sequences you remember from the film, including the legendary tower flyby. Let's welcome Bozo. All right, so unfortunately, Hoot Gibson was not able to make it tonight, but so we have met all of the panel, so we're gonna begin our discussion with the institution that inspired the movie. So the United States Navy Fighter Weapons School, also known as Top Gun, had its roots in the Vietnam War. So in 1968, Captain Frank Ault was ordered to execute a report on the poor air-to-air missile performance during the early stages of that Vietnam War. Part of the findings of that report were the recommendation for an establishment of an advanced fighter weapons school. And in March 1969, Top Gun was born. Top Gun still exists today, and its mission is unchanged. Its goal is to research, develop, and teach the most advanced and lethal fighter tactics to the most capable naval aviators. So with that, we'll begin our discussion. I'll point the first question at Viper. So Top Gun has had a dramatic and vast impact on naval aviation as a whole. What impact has it had on you, or can you describe some of those impacts?
Well, when it first, I hope everybody can hear me, okay? Can you hear me, Matt? When the school started, it was because of Frank Ault, who did a study which said that the kill ratio that we had in Vietnam in 1967 was about 2.5 to 1. Air Force kill ratio was about 2.5 to 1. And that meant that for every 2.5 kills we had, the enemy got 1 kill. And it was not very good. The kill ratio in Korea was, I think, about 8 to 1. Second World War, it was probably around 8 to 9, maybe 10 to 1. But the Navy was not performing very well. So one of his recommendations that he came up with was that there be a graduate school of fighter tactics that would start at Miramar. And the Navy took it and said, okay, we'll do it. And I happened to be an instructor in VF-121 at the time. And so I was not one of the cadre of instructors that started. There were 9 of them, I won't name them all, headed by a guy named Dan Pedersen. They had the first class, I think, in March of 69. And it was in a little hut out in front of VF-121. It was really more like a pretty good outhouse. But luckily it was air conditioned. There were 2 classes taught, and then one of the air to ground instructors, a guy named John Nash, had to leave, and he invited me to come in and be an instructor in air to ground. And so I went from VF-121 over to Top Gun to teach their classes. So when you think about what we were thinking about at the time, you have to think that we were operating out of a little hut. 2, it was a brand new school. We didn't know whether it would succeed or not. And 3, we wanted to succeed for one reason alone. We wanted to improve the ability of the average naval fighter pilot in the Vietnam War to the point where the kill ratio would become acceptable. So it was, in those days, it was many more specific reasons that we were working so hard to try to teach these guys graduate tactics. I'll let it go with that.
That's awesome. Anybody else have any inputs on Top Gun's immediate impact?
He covered it.
I will say that at the end of 1972, now remember, we didn't bomb North Vietnam between 1968 and 1972. And they started the school in 69. Well, in 1972, Linebacker 2 started again. And we started the air-to-air engagements. And we shot down 48 airplanes in about 9 months. And the kill ratio went from 2.5 to 1 to 16 to 1. I hate to say this, but during the same time frame, the Air Force had a 2.5 to 1 kill ratio in 1967 and 1968. And by the end of 1972, their kill ratio was still 2.5 to 1. The difference between what the Air Force did and what the Navy did was Top Gun.
Said well.
All right. So, Duke, you were one of the first graduates of Top Gun. What aspects of the training made you and Iris so lethal
actually,
in disguise?
Well, actually, I wasn't chosen to be a Top Gun student. The Enterprise had that big fire, and VF-96 was slated to go back out, but they had a lot of people killed in that fire. And when they brought the airplanes back, I was supposed to go to the VF-96, but they were all licking their wounds and I had no place to go, so they stashed me in Top Gun. My job was to write the sims for the AIM-9D Sidewinder. I mean, where do you shoot it? What's the distance? What the angles? And I got to fly every single time in the back seat, sometimes 3 times a day in the back seat with Mel Holmes and Jim Rudelson. All these guys were Top Gun instructors. And then my skipper in VF-96 said, we want you to fly the F-4 every day to keep them exercised, the ones we had. And I said, you want me to fly by myself in a fan with no instructor in the back seat? And they said, yeah, you're a fighter pilot now. So I was flying every day in A4s in the back seat looking from the bad guy size, and then flying the F4 and taking it up and seeing what I could do, like how its altitude did I lose at 250 knots doing a split S or 500 knots, get the feel of the airplane in the turn, and then going back to Top Gun and sitting down and listening to the classes like Pete and them were giving us and learning. I had a big advantage when I got against my first MiGs. When I came back off of the airplane as the first MiG, first ace in the Vietnam War, the reporter hit me and said, well, Duke, what would you want to say? And I said, I'm alive today, and it was true because of Top Gun. And they thought about not funding Top Gun, and Jim Rudelson told me, Cobra told me, said, Duke, they kept Top Gun going because you said that you survived of it, and then they just kept the squadron going. And it's the premier squadron in the Navy, and guys like Pete and Jim Rudelson and all the other guys that we learned from, that's where I learned to stay alive.
Pretty awesome. All right, Willie, so you, after Vietnam, served as a Top Gun instructor. So what aspects of aerial combat did you try to instill in the Top Gun students?
Sure.
How did you best teach that?
What I tried to do was to point out to the students, based on our combat experiences, the most important way to approach combat was simple goals, simple plan. Goals without a plan is nothing more than a wish. Relentless preparation. Repetition produces confidence. Attention to detail. When am I most hurt? When am I most vulnerable? Satisfied. The day I stop wanting to get better is the day I stop being good. Repeat the process. The glue that holds all that together is self-discipline. Anybody can be self-disciplined on occasion. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about that gritty, day in and day out self-discipline. And we told our students, if you want your performance to improve, improve your self-discipline.
Awesome. Any other thoughts?
That's Bye. It.
No, you're not touching that one. Tough act to follow. All right, so next one's to you. So you were on the Top Gun staff. The original movie was produced. Kind of an open-ended question, but what aspects do you think were accurately portrayed of Top Gun or naval aviation culture, and maybe what was the biggest misconceptions from the American public?
Okay. So I was a Top Gun instructor. I became an instructor in 1984. And they filmed the original Top Gun movie in 1985, and it was released in 86. And before they filmed it, a gentleman like Viper and—
Be good to me, Bio. Be good to me.
talented screenwriters who were good writers, they talked to the guys who really did it, and then they came up with this story. And the original story was just— it was very exciting, but it was just unrealistic. It was just too fantastic. And so they, to their credit, they worked with the Top Gun staff and other people to hammer this story and move it into the realm of more realistic, more plausible. So I think, but still they made a good movie. I mean, it was an exciting movie and the number one movie of the year. And one of the things that came through as realistic was when Maverick's having problems and the mentoring culture of Top Gun. When the skipper talked to him and the instructors are, you know, saying, fly him again, get him, keep him up there and stuff. And I thought that was one of the aspects that was realistic. The unrealistic things, how much time do we have?
We got all kinds of time. Until they cut us off.
The biggest unrealistic thing was actually one of the things that made it a good movie, and it was the exaggerated personalities of the actor, of the characters. That, you know, you've got the hothead, you've got people, you know, saying things to each other that make great lines, but in a Navy fighter squadron, there's different personalities, but people learn to work together and exist together and have a little bit more maturity. But still, it made a good movie. Now, one of the other unrealistic things was how close the airplanes flew together. As, you know, Roloff, you know this, everyone up here knows this. We have training rules where airplanes are supposed to stay separated from each other and stuff, but it looked so much better on the screen when they were so close. So Bozo was flying in an F-14, I was in the back of an F-5F, and we watched Bozo fly by so close that, you know, I could almost read his name tag on his flight suit, which is something we would never do in real life, but we were filming a movie, and so we arranged it, and we did it, and it worked. It looked good on the screen.
He's leaving out the part when I went by, he had a big bovine look on his face, because I was so close.
So, you know, some people enjoy pointing out all the flaws. That's their game. I think it was a good movie, and it raised the visibility of naval aviation and Top Gun, so it's worth it.
Absolutely. So Viper, are we going to be able to dispel any rumors? Was Tom Skerritt's character Viper actually based on you?
No. The call sign is correct. The writers came to me, Jack Epps and Jim Cash, and told me that we were doing a thing about call signs. We had about 50 of them there. And they said, well, we'd like to use your call sign in the movie. And I said, well, who are you going to use it for? And I was a little bit worried because I'd never been the CEO of Top Gun. And they said, we want the CEO of Top Gun to have the call sign Viper. And I said, well, okay, but you got to understand, I was never the CEO of Top Gun. And they said, okay, we're going to use it anyway. And of course, it stuck. And then you get a little older, you know, and this call sign's kind of been around for a pretty long time. And I don't know if you know it or not, I docent on the USF Midway, if any of you ever go down to San Diego. I docent on the Midway every now and again. And I tell everybody when I give a talk that really my call sign is Viper, but I'm a little older now, and they changed my call sign to Diaper.
Are you going to cut that out in the release
version? Yeah, in the back, they'll take that part out. All right, so Bozo, so you got to do a lot of the Tomcat flight sequences for the movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
What was your favorite one, or do you have any favorites?
Well, there's tons. First, I should say that in that time frame, these three guys right here, they knocked down some MiGs in that time frame, and they were Top Gun guys. I knocked down some beers. I was the F-14 aerial coordinator. My counterpart, who's not here, a guy named Rat Willard, he was the opposite of Top Gun. We would put things together that would fit. The filming of the movie had no CGI in it. I like to bring that point up, as opposed to Maverick. And CGI makes movies great. And so Maverick, the Top Gun Maverick movie is great because of that. But we had to hard film everything off of an airplane. And our assets to do that with was Clay Lacy had a Learjet out of Burbank, had one of the type cameras that they used to film this movie. That was mounted vertically in the fuselage, a little periscope underneath, so we could do what we call free flight form next to that Learjet with no reference to that airplane. And we did a lot of section work and a lot of tail chase. You see all that in the movie. And then another platform we used was up at NES Fallon. We did a 2-week dead up there, which was pretty fun, and no adult supervision. And so we had some cameras that they took up on top of a mountain range between these two valleys that were conventional weapons targets that the Navy practiced with. And it allowed us, with those cameras up to the cliff's edge there, we could take the A-4 and the F-5 and the F-14 and run maneuvers. You couldn't really film some things completely. You could do the entry or the exit or something in the middle. Proximities to the airplane, safety, and a lot of things always being the case. We never took chances. Everything was briefed. Much like we fly in real combat, much like we train for real combat, everything's programmed. The hard deck that they talk about, that's in there in the movie for a reason. It lets the public know that the Navy works with a 10,000-foot hard deck. They may have lowered that to 5, though, I think, with the F. They have better jets now. But and so those things were important. Our integrity and not hurting each other or the assets was really important. So you know, I can't overemphasize how professional we were. And it was the taxpayer's dollar, so you didn't want to ding anything up. And that all got put together, much like Bio saying. And the movie obviously is a movie, but you talk about something that works and iconic. The airplanes themselves have personalities, as did the characters in the movie. You know, Maverick and Iceman. There's such great things. Brag on Bio here. Goose is his character more or less because he was a Rio for Maverick. The Rio, the backseater, I did about 900 hours as a backseater and retreaded to be a pilot and did a couple thousand hours as a pilot in the Tomcat. So I have a unique perspective in both seats. And the guy in the back seat there, your Rio, he's your banker, he's your cheerleader, he's a lot of things for you, he's your brother. And so you need those eyes, you need that talent that's back there to make the plane work. And those characters like Goose and the way they were portrayed in the movie I consider it quite accurate. The competitiveness between Iceman and Maverick is quite accurate. The CEO, Tom Skerrick, the CEO, that's the CEO you always wanted. He was He was the best pilot. He was mature. He was the guy to lead everything, and he was trying to nurture Maverick out of, you know, the psychological barricades that he had built for himself into a real pilot, because he knew his dad in the movie. The storyline is very good in that area. And his nemesis was Iceman, because they were competitive. And so, but at the same time, the bigger mission was the adversary that was out there, those black MiGs. And so that movie worked on many levels. We were certainly flying closer than we would ever fly with standoff missiles and stuff. I can attest, and I'll finish my talkie, the movie crew did listen to us when we said, well, that's not real. We're out here. We're not in here like that. So they filmed a little bit with us out here, and you just had one jet going, and no perspective. You couldn't figure out what was going on. Who is it? You couldn't even see their helmets, you know. So we go back to this, and they go, yeah, that's working, you know. So you get the gist. You guys see enough TV to understand. So that's my shtick.
Awesome. Duke, you had something to add?
The first time I met Cruz, I was just taken over as commanding officer of BF-126, the adversary squadron, and I'm getting my white Navy choker off, and three kids came into the office and said, Commander Cunningham, can we talk to you? And I said, sure, have a seat. And the little short guy stood up and said, why haven't you participated and you've been avoiding us? And I said, avoiding you, I'm sorry, I don't know who you are. Well, it was Tom Cruise, Anthony Edwards, and Val Kilmer. And they said that the Navy was not going to film part of the movie again because it started turning to a spoof and more of a comedy. And they said, would you go down with Jerry Bruckheimer and Don Simpson and give them some of the scenes, things you had done for real? And I said, sure. Well, I had gone over a bear, and he tried to fly me in the water, and I passed underneath him and reversed the airplane and came down on this big giant bomber and dove at him. And just at the last second, I put the stick forward and stopped it. And when the bomber drivers looked up, I communicated with them. And so, I met my wife by singing You Lost That Loving Feeling, and she hated it because she knew I used it a lot and it worked most of the time. Another one was, I did fly by the tower and got in trouble. Matter of fact, I didn't have to see the captain of the base. I had to see the Admiral of Common Air Pack, and he's the one that told me if I did anything like that again, he'd chew my butt out. But I had a great opportunity of being in Top Gun with Pete and the main guys in the squadron, and that's where I learned how to fight and survive. And I would not have survived unless I had gone through those exercises, and I ended up as an instructor as well as a student, and then took over the commanding Air Force of the squadron. And then I got to fly against the MiGs up in Dreamland. I got to fly against the MiG-21 and the MiG-17 before I ever went overseas. And that was a big challenge for us. So that's how I met Tom Cruise.
Jack Epps and Jim Cash, we had telephone calls together. Cash taught at Michigan State, and Jack Epps taught at USC, and they worked together. And so they'd call me about three times a week, and we'd have calls talking about what we had to have or didn't have to have in the movie. One of the things they decided they wanted to have was the Top Gun trophy. Now, Top Gun doesn't have a trophy. It's never had a trophy. It would never have a trophy. And the reason it won't is because if Top Gun had a trophy, the guys that go to the school are so type A that no one would ever graduate. There'd just be a bunch of mid-airs out in the warning area, and then everybody'd be done with it. So I said, no, we can't have a Top Gun trophy. Well, They won, I lost. And that happened quite often. You learn to hate mom and pop in Oklahoma. Mom and pop in Oklahoma are the generic people that are going to see the movie. So every day you get in a fight with Jerry Bruckheimer, and his answer to you is, we've got to do that because mom and pop in Oklahoma want to see that. So we're going to do it that way because we're Hollywood and you're reality and they don't mix. So I have to tell you that I lost a lot of battles.
Still an iconic movie, though.
Yeah, it is.
Just maybe not the exact way you wanted to portray it.
I will say this one time. You'll all be able to appreciate this. Everybody talks about retention. Navy retention went and skyrocketed after that movie came out. And rightly so. It was a good movie for the public. It worked out really well. Well, what I didn't realize is a lot of these guys were going to decide they want to go in the Navy. So about 20 years later, all of a sudden, all these 8-year-old kids were coming back to me and saying, you're the guy that did the movie, aren't you? And I want you to know, I went in the Navy, and the Navy's nothing like that. And not only that, it's all your fault.
Oh, man. All right, so recently we have Top Gun Maverick, and then we saw the trailer for Devotion coming out shortly. So, Duke, it's awesome that naval aviation is kind of coming back into the public spotlight. To his point, what do you think is great about naval aviation that the public should get to know and see and love?
Really?
I would say with the movie, Maverick had to solve a problem. But today's Top Gun instructors, the lieutenants, they already know how to solve that problem. They're that good. Not only do they know how to solve the problem, they can teach it. And one of the techniques they use, which are very important for Top Gun, in their debriefs, they put up two words on the board after we get done determining who won and who lost. Our emphasis at all times is downplaying the who and upplaying the how and the why. So we put two words up on the board, the goods and the others. And we ask the class to tell us what happened today. Tell us about the goods. And they're painfully honest. They pretty much hit it square on. Then we want to know, tell us about the others. And again, they're painfully honest, and that's what we want them to make sure they're clear on. Stay focused on what you did well today. Work on what you need to do to get better. Don't ever be satisfied. Now, my experience has been, I've been in and out of Top Gun on a regular basis for almost the past 50 years. And your typical Navy fighter pilots have a pretty severe macho image. But I can tell you from firsthand experience, despite that macho image, just about all of them have a tremendous ability for love, affection, intimacy, and caring. It just doesn't involve anybody else.
That word on your shoulder.
So Duke, we were backstage, and you're telling us about some of your experiences. Do you mind retelling one of the stories about when you'd been hit by an SA-2 guideline missile and then took the Phantom 20 miles back out to sea to get rescued? If you don't mind putting you on the spot.
Go ahead, Lou.
You got a shot down. You got it.
Willie and I had knocked down our fifth MiG. And on the way out, we were feeling pretty good. And all of a sudden, over the starboard side, we saw this missile coming up, and I just started to break into it. Luckily, I didn't break into it because the shrapnel would have gone here. It actually hit underneath, and it cut the hydraulic lines. And the airplane started wobbling, and our PC-1 and PC-2, which is our primary hydraulic system, was going out, and I told Willie, I said, we're losing hydraulics. Stay with me, don't get, you know, don't punch out. And I had utility which controls the rudder. And the airplane started yawing like this, and Willie had told me to climb, and so we climbed up, and we're at about, 26,000 feet? And we're just close to 0.9 Mach, and all of a sudden the airplane went upside down. And I know the only time I'd ever asked for divine help was when I got in trouble. And as the airplane went upside down, I thought, God, get me out of this. I don't want to be a prisoner or die. And I put the left rudder and I started, and it rolled itself, put the burner back into speed and tried to climb further. And I remember thinking, God had nothing to do with this. It was just my superior flying skills. And about that time, the airplane went back upside down. And the thought came to mind, I said, God, get me out of here. I really didn't mean it. But after that, on the way out, coming down in a parachute, I made a decision to find out if there was a God. And I sat out and I found that. And I want to tell you, if you ever get in trouble, if you get on your knees and say a little prayer, somebody's going to listen to you.
All right, so bio, with the exception of me, but I'm not allowed to present my opinions on stage. So you're the most recent Top Gun instructor that we have on stage. What can you give us a little kind of what it was like to be a Top Gun instructor?
Oh yeah. Like I said, I became an instructor in '84. I finished in '87. And the one of the amazing things was when you go through Top Gun as a student, which is a requirement before you're an instructor. For me, I sat in the audience and I watched these guys give their lectures, and they were incredibly knowledgeable and precise. And then we get in the airplane, and they're also extremely precise, and they'll also kick your ass, you know. So they're great fighter pilots as well as teachers. And you admire them, and then you become an instructor, and you go like, wow, I'm an instructor now. But then you sit there and you go, wait a minute, how do you get to be that good? And for me, it was like, oh, it takes a heck of a lot of work. And so, you know, I don't know about you guys, but other guys have said, you know, can I do this? And you have a little doubt, am I good enough? And how did I get here? But what I found was, as long as you have the commitment, you put forth the effort, it takes a lot of effort, your fellow instructors will do whatever they have to support you and bring you up to their level. So one of the great things about Top Gun was they had standards. They tell you the standards very clearly. They don't bend the standards for new instructors or for anybody. They raise you up to help you meet those standards. And you know, Willie talked about some of these principles. And actually, Roloff, I'm gonna pump my books. I wrote a few books about my aviation experience, and I'll be doing a book signing tomorrow in the author's corner at 1 o'clock.
Cool.
And I explained some of these things. I explained some of my doubts and some more background. So if you want to hear more about it after this, but you can, if you want to hear more about it after this, you can, you know, pick up one of the books. But the fact that it was a team working together, do whatever it takes to help the guy make the standards, was one of the most impressive things to me about being a Top Gun instructor.
Awesome. Thank you.
Good job.
All right. So, Bozo, I'll hit you with another one. So, you went through as a student, and then, you know, as we talked about, flew a lot of the scenes for Top Gun. What should we all know about the Tomcat and what it was like to go through the course and then fly it in the movie?
Well, it is exactly like Bio says. You go through as a student, because we were students, although it's sort of a graduate level. A Navy pilot gets 250 wings, three jets over a couple of years just to get to that spot. You could call that you know, a BS degree if you want to, and then he goes through the replacement air group, gets to a squadron, gets a cruise under his belt, and gets all that extra experience and training is there. You call that a master's. And Top Gun is very much a doctoral type program in that they break down all the enemy assets and what they're capable of, and they find the way to lick them in a quick synopsis. And so when you get there, you get this mountain of volume of stuff to read, and you, if you thought professors in college were mean there, you should see these guys. And so number one is you don't sleep, you read this stuff, they're all better than you are, they're all sharper than you are, they do this job all the time. And your squadron reputation, because basically the two sharpest guys, and I guess that won't work because I got to go, but just the same, the two guys that the CO decides would best be utilized going through the Top Gun school and bring that information back. That's what you do. You come back to squadron and teach the rest of the guys that didn't go to Top Gun what you learned in Top Gun, so that information filters even deeper. And so you find out in that doctoral process, it's hard work. These guys are sharper than you are. But that group effort that BIOS talks about and how each of the structures were very uniform, they did raise your level. And when you leave Top Gun and graduate, much like the movie, no trophy, you know that you are at the zenith of your ability in this airplane, and it feels like it. And so you really notice it the most the first time you do any adversarial work against another F-14, if you're just in-house training, or especially against the Air Force at Red Flag. You're taking your plane further than you did. You're sharper than you are. Your actions are quicker. It all works. And it goes all the way back to that Top Gun school that Pete Pettigrew was in way back in the day, how to get from 2.5 to 16. We talk about kill ratios, and that's not so, you know, so economically correct in terms of people's feelings. But the reality is you go out there to make sure that that bad guy doesn't come harm your ship, harm your shipmates, or advance himself in a way that hurts America. And so you get really serious in the military, and I'm a proponent of the military, that you go to this school in particular, you become the best of the best, and you take that back to the squadron. And Top Gun does that. It has always done that, and by the grace of God, it gets to keep going, it'll continue to do that with the assets we have now.
Awesome. Yeah.
All right?
You got it.
Yeah.
So we were also backstage. We were kind of we were comparing watches. I think a lot of aviators have watch people. Bio's got his Bremont Martin Baker watch that you only can get if you've ejected from an aircraft. So this is a random poll. How many of you have ejected from an aircraft? It's pretty good. Not too often. You're left out of company.
But I've got my watch.
Do you want to tell the other story, or you want to skip that one?
Which one? Oh, no.
All right, we'll skip that.
It's a civilian story.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you probably skip that story.
Actually,
we'll skip that story.
No. It just, I love this watch. It's a Breitling. It's a Top Gun watch. It's got Top Gun insignia on it, and an F-4 Phantom. Because I love the Phantom. And I was down in Sao Paulo, Brazil, about 6 years ago. And I was walking along the street to go to dinner with two other pilots. We were in a G550. And a guy jumps out from behind a wall and comes up to me, little guy. And he stands in front of me, goes, "Give me your watch." I didn't know what to say. I didn't say anything. I just kind of thought about it. Wait, you know, that's my Top Gun watch. Didn't say anything. So he looks at me again, and he goes like this, and he pulls out a 9mm, and he goes like that, and he goes right at my head, just like this. He says, "Give me your watch." And I'm thinking, no, that's my... It's my Top Gun watch. I can't give him my Top Gun watch. So I couldn't think of anything to do, and I just shouted at him, "No!" as loud as I could, turned around and walked away. And he kind of slithered in behind the wall. And that was sort of the end of it, except the other two pilots had seen the whole thing, and they come running back to me, and they look at me, and they go, Pettigrew, that's the stupidest thing I've ever seen. You're supposed to give him your watch. But I got it.
I got nothing. I got nothing. Luckily.
Some great stories. So we also talked about, my next tour will be to command a fighter squadron. We've got several commanding officers up here, or former commanding officers. I think a lot of what Top Gun continues to do is based upon the culture that it just continues to permeate everybody who goes there. Does anybody have any thoughts or words of wisdom for military leaders, civilian leaders?
Oh, man. Yeah, I'll give you
open-ended. One. There we go.
When you become a CEO of a squadron, in the Navy, in the Air Force, whatever it is, you're given a whole lot of credits from the people that you're the leader of. So you have a change of command, and you become a CEO, and you're in charge of like 400 or 500 people and 20 airplanes, and you say to your, and if you're smart, you want to protect those chips they've given you. Because they're out there wanting to be on your side, and they want you to do really well. And if you're a good CEO, you'll gain more chips. If you're not a very, if you're an other and not a good, you're going to use up all your chips, and it's going to be a waste of time. And it's all about leadership, and you have to lead. And they've given you these chips, and you got to use them for good, not for others. That's all I'll say. Thank you.
Good, dude.
I was CO of the adversary squadron, and it was a little different. We were shore-based, and I had 6 female officers. That, you know, it's different than most of the fighter squadrons. At that time, we didn't have women basically into aviation. And what I did is I called them in and I said, most women just do paperwork. If you want, I'm gonna get you qualified in the back seat of the A4, and you're gonna fly with us over to El Centro and Yuma and be controllers for the dogfights that happen. I said, I want you to be everything that you can be as a woman. And all of them got backseat qualifs, and they ran the tax range over in El Centro and did that. I still get letters from them. We had Mary Lou Jorgensen was the first woman that came to Miramar in a squadron, and the pilots gave her hell. She had a heck of a time blending in as the first woman in a fighter base. And I brought her, her name was Mary Lou Jorgensen. Her call sign was Jugs, obviously for the reason that they named it. And I brought her over to the squadron, got her in the back seat and front seat, and let her fly and flew some tactics and stuff, and she did well. Another thing that we did was Donnie Cochran was one of the first Blue Angels, and he wanted to fly in the A4. I put him in there, and he got to fly. I flew in the back seat with him, and he got to fly the A4. So your squadron reaches beyond just your own squadron. We won best squadron in the row for 3 years in a row because of our kids were attention to detail. But when you're working with the girls and the enlisted females. If an enlisted female was a second class and a third class male said, no, you're a woman, they got penalized because a second class petty officer was equal to a second petty officer that was a male. And so we treated the females just like the males, and it was up to what their capabilities were. And I still get letters from the females.
Bio, you wanted to?
Yeah, roll off. One thing that, go ahead, you want to add on to that?
I was just going to say, there's 3 simple questions that your squadron's going to ask you. Question number 1, sir, do you know me? Because if you know me, I'm going to know you. Sir, do you care about me? Because if you care about me, I'm going to care about you. And sir, are you willing to help me get better? Because if you are, I'm going to get better, and that's going to help you. You cannot spend too much time with your people. That's the key. The other key is a good, supportive family. Nourish those relationships, cherish them, don't ever take them for granted. Now, I've been married to the same gal for 43 years. Recently, I asked her, I said, so, what's it take being married to a guy like me for 43 years? Not a smart question. This fast, she said, simple, low expectations.
Baya?
Yeah, I was going to say a lot of what Willie just said. And a couple of things, because I was the skipper of VF-211, Tomcat Squadron, 14 Tomcats, about 300 people. When I was a CO in the mid-90s, female sailors and officers had come further. They were much better integrated than when Duke was a CO, and I remember those days. Still a few issues, but much better integrated. But in terms of what Willie said, I read a comment in a command survey by one of our sailors who said that the previous CO before me, he goes, I see him around the ship and he doesn't even know me. He doesn't even know I'm in his squadron. And so I made it a point to, and I didn't know every single one of those sailors' names. There was like 250 people, but I knew almost all of them. And so you, as a future skipper, I challenge you to do what Willie just said, and another, which is get to know your people. And one easy way to do it is spend a lot of time in their work centers and just talk to them and listen to them. They will appreciate the heck out of it. You'll learn a lot more, and that will make your entire unit more effective and more capable. So, and enjoy yourself.
All right, one kind of like, we'll call it a capstone question. Any flying events or specific flights anybody has any good stories about? No, we talked a lot about Top Gun, but just flying? All right, Bozo, you go first.
Say the question again, please.
What was your favorite flight? Any great stories?
Well, I got tons. Actually, you know, the tower flyby is a really good example in that, I'll take a couple minutes to say it. I wasn't the guy I was going to be in the movie Top Gun. But my squadron CO had gotten money for his squadron, VF-51, to go up to Red Flag, which is a big training exercise, a very good one, at Nellis and, Air Force Base there. And I had orders out of the squadron in about 5 months. And one of the ways it works in the Navy, I was in there already for almost 40 months. That's a good deal going up to Nellis for that. And so I was going to stay behind and manage the jets to stay behind and the troops to stay behind. And you take a cadre and go up there and you do that. And so, and it makes sense to me, they're not going to waste that kind of training on me because I'm leaving. You want to put the training into the hands of the people that are going to be in the squadrons that are going to forward deploy. So there's no hard feelings in that, just how it works. And so, but I felt pretty good because I'm going to be the guy in charge back at Miramar at the hangar there. So I came in at two-ish. Came in at 10-ish, going with 2-ish. I probably came in at 2-ish. But anyway, the John Simpkin, who was the liaison for the Admiral, the Paramount people decided that they wanted to quit doing this the filming that was on the ground and wanted to get into the air. And the Top Gun flyby sequence was the first sortie they flew. He calls me up and said, hey, they want to move the flying up a month. Well, our squadron specifically went to the desert a month ahead of when this thing's supposed to start. So that caught the squadron by surprise. And I told John, I said, hey, you know, the squadron's in the desert. They're not here. And John did the typical Navy thing. Says, well, if you can't do it, there are plenty of other squadrons here that can. So I knew my CO wanted this thing. So I called him up and tried like he could to get some assets down there to do this. The Air Force had them all tied up. It's very specific how they do that. And you can't pull an asset that's going to be in a training cycle from up there. So he said to me, and you're asking for my favorite thing, and there's many, but this will be it. that says, you're going to have to be the guy that does that tire flyby. And I'm going, I can do this. I can do this.
We did flip 50.
And so I had one Rio in the squadron that was left behind as well. And he had his letter in to get out, going to be a Ryan Aircraft Corporation, actually. And I said, his name was Mark Slichter, Slick. And I said, Mark, guess what we're getting ready to go do? And he goes, what? And he says, well, we're going to go down and find the producer and the director down at the tower, find out what they want, and we're going to man up an F-14, and we're going to go roaring by the tower, glass level, a couple of four times while they film us, you know. And he was beside himself. So we manned up that airplane, and oddly enough, this is too much detail, but we always take off to the west. This time we're taking off to east. The one of the motors had a compressor stall, and I had to abort the takeoff. So I'm thinking, oh man, this is my chance, and the motor quit. And but anyway, we taxi back in there, and then I look over, there's one more plane there. I said, well, let's take that one. Now, you understand, they painted this airplane to go do the tower flyby. It's got the number on it, it's got the tail logo. The other airplane's just a patched up piece of crud that they didn't want to take with them up to Nellis, you know. But if you go by the window fast enough, who's going to see what's on the tail? So that was my theory. So I went back out there, got airborne the whole time. I did a bunch of those flybys. They were a hoot. Doing a big circuitous pattern around the thing. The little cul-de-sac, so the neighborhoods around Miramar were filling up with little people looking up, you know. And I'd shoot across Miramar Road, east-west highway, north of the base there, and all the brake lights would come on. And I learned a few things about trees. They're taller than 100 feet. That's where the tower's at. So there was some training in that as well, you know. But the big part of that was that I knew that I had to do this thing and not mess it up, and it was for all the guys that ever wanted to do that kind of stuff. And and so it comes off in the movie really well. It's got a great story behind it with the air boss. And I'll finish by one, everybody loves trivia. If you look at the movie and the tower flyby scenes there, it's not about me, it's about the guy that dumps coffee on himself. If you look behind him, he says that the pattern's full, right? Well, they had me, and my other job besides flying an airplane was I had all charge of all the F-14 assets and the troopers and how much it cost and everything, and move them around, get things where they are. He wanted, the movie company, production company, Tony Scott, wanted the whole background behind the guy in the tower with that coffee cup be full of F-14s. So I had to go around to each of the squadrons and beg them, can I come tow one of your F-14s? And if you look out there, there's a sea of F-14s right out in front of the tower. In the real world, there are no F-14s out in front of that tower. You know? They're out where the hangars are, right, with the different squadrons. So it took me probably a day and a half to get, you know, those things out there for this film thing. And I at no time did I know that that's what it was going to be for. That was kind of a zinger, you know. And I said, well, they're doing something out there, so that's what I did. Anyway.
Sure.
Cool.
Is she over there?
All right. Well, thank you to our special panel. Please put your hands together for them. And one last thing, so we've got some special presents. These are actually handcrafted by my dad. They're ChallengeCon boards. So they've got the Top Gun logo on there, so you can all put your challenge coins in there. And let's once again thank our panel. Thank you all very much.
Very nice.
Nice job. Thanks, Jeff.
That's too cool. Too cool.
Yes, thank you, Dad.
Awesome.
Thank you. To the patch. Nice to meet you.
Thank you.